that. I'd like to, a couple more things before we jump in. Please keep in mind, like all our programs, we want to share ideas and experiences openly with one another. But keep in mind that some ideas may work for you, some may not. You're going to have to, you know, pick off what works for you or what doesn't. And as we're chatting and in all our programs, you know, please no soliciting for your particular nonprofit that you think deserves extra help or for funds you're setting up or whatnot. And the last thought is, you know, we're moving through a dynamic situation here. The virus, the response, the options available for testing, for treatment, for medical supplies, the needs of the community, they're constantly changing, literally in some cases, minute to minute. So today's great idea may be tomorrow's less desirable approach, but don't let that freeze you into inaction. Rather, remain tuned in to your community and trust your best judgment. Nobody knows your community that you're funding better than you. So don't be afraid to make some bold moves. And I think you'll hear some interesting stuff as we go along. And with that, I'd like to begin with Lauren Scott. She's the executive director of the Harris and Eliza Kemper Fund in Texas. Her bio is in the piece, the announcement, so I won't go over that. But Lauren, could you begin perhaps with sharing with everybody just a very brief capsule of what areas, and by that I mean programs, types of organizations, and so forth, that the foundation would normally be funding?
Sure. Hi, everyone. So the Harris and Eliza Kempner Fund, it's a 75-year-old family foundation in Galveston, Texas, which is a little barrier island off the coast, 50 miles from Houston. Historically, the Kempner Fund has been a big supporter of general operating support, but also programs and projects. They also do program-related investments as well. We have 7 program areas, so it's community development, arts and humanities, environment, health, human services, education, and historic preservation. So it's a broad funder and it's place-based, so 95% of funding goes to Galveston.
So I know we chatted last week, so I maybe know some of the answers, but would you share with everybody, please, so what are some of the things that you're doing differently because of the virus?
I think a couple things. One, we're making some governance changes that are going to be discussed actually on executive committee call I'm having right after this call. Just as a temporary, like, how do we operate? We're also working on what will be approved is an emergency electronic fund transfer protocol, because typically we do checks, but right now we got to get funds out the door and checks just aren't possible. From a grant making perspective, we're talking about in terms of pulling 2 levers. How does the Kempner Fund respond to the community need now through its own grant making? You know, some of the things on the table is deploying funds more quickly, doing straight like unrestricted grants or general operating support. Also, grantees who were just awarded in January, converting those grants into unrestricted. So we're capturing those folks that we wouldn't see their applications till later in the year. The other lever is activating the Galveston County Recovery Fund, which is a disaster response mechanism that Galveston has had in place for 10 to 15 years because we are very prone to hurricanes. And so it is both kind of a collective impact model and a way to pool funding from across foundations, private sector, and individuals. And so we just had a call prior to this one with partners where people are indicating they're in. And so it's in the process of bringing in more partners and getting close to publicly activating.
And how have you gone about finding those partners, and have those been easy asks, or is there some arm twisting involved?
Well, the great thing is because it's not great that Galveston is hurricane prone, but having this mechanism in place means that a lot of the key founding partners, which those are primarily the foundations in Galveston, is that there are existing MOUs. And so, for example, Kempner Fund has an MOU with the physical agent of the recovery fund, which is our United Way. And so that existing MOU means if a federally declared disaster happens in our county, there are budgeted funds every year that are then deployed. So there are existing MOUs with key partners, but then also those who maybe don't have MOUs but have participated in the past. So literally the next step calls are being made to some of those secondary partners. I'd have to get back to you if there has to be arm twisting. I don't foresee that, but we don't know yet, right? So yeah.
And from the funds perspective, who made the decisions to do this? Was it you as the ED? Was it the board? Was it what was the catalyst? Who started it? How did it come to be?
Well, I think I've lost track of time. So there was initially a call from staff saying we need to keep an eye. This may, you know, we're used to watching for, you know, the cone of uncertainty with a hurricane, but we were kind of alerting each other that we need to think about this may, COVID may activate the recovery fund. And so I quickly, you know, I'm in conversations with our president, Eliza Quigley. And from there, because the federal declaration came and that MOU kind of already sets that point of action in motion, essentially, you know, the president made the call. And I kept the board informed as to how that mechanism, the recovery fund, has been progressing over the last few days.
So it's, you know, as you said, you're in a hurricane prone area. So I suspect many other communities along the Gulf Coast, Florida, whatnot, have similar mechanisms in place. But I think it's a potential lesson here for people who may live in areas that are disaster prone in other ways. Whether it's flooding in the Midwest, it's earthquakes in the far West, it's forest fires in the Southwest, to utilize existing mechanisms as a way to quickly react and quickly move.
And one thing I would add is I, through another colleague, got connected with Anna Lee with the Chicago Community Foundation. Chicago has a response fund up and going. And what's interesting is far as my knowledge, but if somebody on this call knows better, definitely correct me in the chat log. That mechanism wasn't in place, but they have created it's almost identical to our recovery model, including that United Way, I think, is their physical agent. So other cities and communities, whether they've had this in place or not, are moving.
So there's a great opportunity here for people to be exploring that in their communities. These may exist, because I'm not sure I would have thought of Chicago as a city set up for that. If you said, does New Orleans have it? I'd go, I bet they do. Would not have necessarily picked Chicago. So there's a path to go down. What about financial considerations in all of this? You know, we all, as much or as little money as any of us may have, we all have limited funds. So was there consideration given to that as you've moved ahead?
I think so. That's something that we're definitely, as the Kempner Fund and that the executive committee and the board will be an ongoing conversation, and it will certainly wrestle with it probably in depth on our next call. I think in terms of, you know, I've laid it out in talking with our president, and as we've worked through this, is saying, okay, this is where we know we are now. And so what are the strategies that we can employ now, immediately? And like I said, with the recovery fund, there was already that MOU, it was already budgeted, it's already committed. And so that wasn't, for example, an additional financial consideration, but I think probably like everybody on this call, financial considerations look very different, and certainly for Galveston, than they did with previous hurricanes.
I'm watching the chat log as we're talking here too, and people are popping up with other examples of that kind of thing that's going on. I'm seeing Greater St. Louis, National Education Association Foundation, Lake County outside of Chicago, Vermont Community Foundation. So people are doing this. And somebody asked a question, Megan. I don't know if it applies directly, but let me ask you, because I do know you have to run in a little bit. But is there any mechanism for emergency grants to individuals who are suddenly unemployed, the gig workers, the hotel employees? I learned today of, you know, several hotels that have gone dark for 6 to 8 weeks. My former life in the media, I have many friends in the entertainment business who are now out of work and no place to go. Any thoughts about supporting those people?
That is a conversation that is in midstream. Galveston has a very, I mean, probably next to healthcare. It's a tourist destination, so we're facing those issues right now. Historically, how the recovery fund has worked in terms of addressing like financial need is funding through partners, A, who already have financial assistance kind of built into what they do. Also in the past, what's happened is funding through faith-based and other community organizations. I do know in talking to some other folks who are using a similar kind of pooled fund methodology, they're also trying to figure out, is there a way to directly fund to individuals? So that conversation's midstream, but exactly what you just brought up about the tourist industry and those who are hit hard immediately from a job standpoint, everybody's trying to figure out how do we do that and do it quickly.
Yep. Okay. And I'm watching the clock and I'm watching your time. Let me ask you, I'm going to say one final, and then I have a terrible habit of saying, oh, and one more. But how are you holding up, you and your colleagues, in all of this? And I'm not trying to necessarily equate you with that gig worker who's worried about how am I going to feed my family. But in talking to some of our members, people are running on overdrive to address this. What steps are you taking? How are you guys doing?
It's a great question. I think I'm okay. I will say I'm a social worker by training. So that helps in terms of talking to people and remembering everybody's response to everybody's different defense mechanisms and response. So try to remind myself of that. I think I have to be careful that I think my president's on the call. I have to be careful that, you know, I don't become a workaholic because my defense mechanism, I get very clear in emergency situations about what needs to happen and how we do that work. I've tried to be really mindful. We're two staff members. So, you know, I work very closely with our grants administrator, Vivian, and so try to make sure that we're not just communicating through email, you know, that we're talking to each other, even though we're not in the same office. And so trying to do as much video as possible and then trying to set time aside. I have three young children and my husband works in disaster response. So we're trying to be, we're both working a lot and also trying like, how do we set aside, you know, time, you know, with our kids and as a family unit, just, you know, to get to your kind of self-care piece. I'll be honest with you. We haven't even had the space to think about our own financial security at this point.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a really important point for all of us on this call is that sense of self-care. And we're dealing with something here in the form of a virus that if you start to run yourself down, you're increasing the likelihood that you could contract the virus. And we're seeing it in every state, every city, every town. So that's important. That's incredibly important. Lauren, thank you so much. I hope you can hang with us for another couple minutes and then I know you're off to your meeting, which again is indicative, everyone, of how quickly things are unfolding and things are changing. You know, you've got a meeting with your executive committee in 10 minutes or 8 minutes, whatever, to make some of these decisions. So stuff is happening in real time. So Lauren, thank you so much for
being here. Thanks for having us. And I'm looking forward to hearing from y'all, even if I have to listen to the recording later. So thank you all.
Thank you. I'd love now to move on to Phil Lee from the Robert Sterling Clark Foundation in New York City. Phil, I've known Phil for, I don't know, several years. I don't want either of us to feel that old. But Phil's also one of the architects and leading proponents of trust-based philanthropy. And I think in general, this is a situation where trust really comes into play. But before we dive into that part, Phil, would you give everybody just a very quick overview of, in normal times, what the foundation is all about?
Sure. So the Robert Sterling Clark Foundation is focused on trying to create a more vibrant and equitable New York City. So, and we do that by investing in her people. And so what does that mean? We're really interested in an approach, which is leadership development. And to that extent, we are issue agnostic or identity group agnostic. So we fund folks and groups that run leadership development programs because we're really interested in bringing new voices and new leadership into kind of all the different sectors and the nonprofit sector and the vibrancy of that, doing that work. So that is kind of the focus of our work. You know, all of our grants are general operating support, and we actually tether on a professional development award on top of that to make sure that the organizations that we support invest in their own staff and their own well-being.
Well, from what I, you know from corresponding before today about all of this. I think, you know, you're demonstrating some great leadership in what's going on. So would you share with us some of the things that, the foundation is doing now that's breaking the norms, if not for you, for many other foundations?
So for us, I think one of the first things that we did was go out, like many of you, to our grantees and the community to hear what was going on and what their concerns were and what the challenges were. And we did that about a week and a half ago. And really just sort of heard what the what that was and spent the weekend sort of devising our own plan and our own response to what we were hearing and what we were seeing from the folks that are our grantees. And so we
Phil, I'm going to interrupt you for one sec because I'd love to probe on the first part of that answer because I think it's important. When you said we went out into the community, so you went out, or you and your colleagues, and met with the people you're funding. You really saw what was happening. Or was this on the phone, or how did this happen?
It was mostly on the phone and mostly some Zoom, so using this technology, really trying to talk with them and hear what they were going through and what their challenges were at this moment.
But it was human-to-human contact as opposed to just send us an email and tell us.
Right.
And I think that's the point I was going for, that this is one of those cases where it's really important to talk directly to people, to expedite what might normally be, oh, answer these questions, tell us how you're doing, and that takes time. So I apologize for interrupting, but I think that's a really important thing that you're doing.
Yeah, no problem. And so we sent out our response to our community on Monday. So we spent the weekend crafting it, working with our board president, our board chair, and then went to our entire board, and they responded overnight from Sunday night to Monday morning. And we went out with our response to the community that afternoon. And, you know, happy to enumerate what's embedded in that, if that's helpful, or to.
Yeah, I think a little bit would be, please.
So we kind of listed about 6 points. One was that we were going to honor all of our grant commitments for this year, which I'm sure many of you are doing as well. The thing that we decided to do was add one additional year of funding to every grant that we have outstanding. And so we call that plus one. And so if your grant expired in 2019, we will automatically add another year and fund you for 2020. If you have a multi-year grant that's in play right now, we will add another year to the end of the grant. And the idea was to eliminate any need for nonprofit organizations to worry about doing anything in 2020. We want them to focus on their communities and their work and not on us. Third thing was kind of relax a lot of our reporting standards. We already use a verbal reporting system, but we wanted to just release everybody from any of that obligation and said, you know, later this year, 6 months from now, we'll check in with you and we can do that verbal report, what we call a chat or Zoom or not at all. And so we leave it to them to make that decision or that call. We're offering virtual office hours to any of our grantees. If they want to talk about anything or if there are situations that they want to try to wrestle with, to the extent that we can be thought partners, we are offering that as well.
And Phil, on that, I know we're, you know, this is unfolding and we're not very far into it, but have people been taking advantage of that? And if they have, what are the kinds of things they've been bringing up?
So a number of them have talked about certainly the financial implications. Some of them have galas and different things like that. Since a lot of our groups run leadership development programs, which tend to be in person, how do you convert that kind of training into a virtual environment? And what are the challenges and what are the best strategies that sort of sit with that? A number of them are really just trying to kind of get their heads around what does the business planning look like or financial planning and what does mapping that out the future look like? And so those are the kinds of things that we've had at least come back initially to us.
And have you been putting any of your the people you fund together so that they can brainstorm? I understand you guys are a great resource, but acting as a hub. But are you connecting any of those folks, or have you thought about that?
We are. So we are offering an opportunity for all of our executive directors to be in community with one another. We actually brought all the program directors of the folks who run those leadership programs. They already had a meeting actually earlier today. And so we're trying to find ways that we can create spaces where the folks who are nonprofits in our community can come together and use each other as resources. Many of them are already in a learning community together, so there's already kind of built-in trust and understanding about what that means to be in community.
That's great. And I, you know, any financial considerations in doing the plus ones or whatever? Was there a great scrubbing of the books, or was that just a, well, we're doing it?
Definitely a conversation about it. There are certainly financial implications, and granted how volatile the markets are right now. But we as an institution sort of said, we have already said we are committed to these nonprofits and what they represent and how important they are to us and hopefully the city as well, that we want to assure them that we are going to be there for them and to help them continue their work so they don't need to worry about it. For us as an institution, certainly our investment committee and our board as a whole took a look at the books, but the real thing was, you know, if we don't do it now, when are we going to do this? And so increasing payout and things like that, that actually dropped by the wayside more quickly and more easily than I thought it would. I think there were certainly some heavy duty discussions, but like in this time and in what's going on right now, the board actually came together pretty quickly in terms of doing that.
I'll just share in the foundation where I'm a trustee. We've done some of these similar kinds of things. And, one, you know, I said to one of the others, you know, I haven't even looked at the portfolio, because this is important. We can worry about that later. And, I also, and I'm not an investment guy, a financial guy. So I'm sure there are people out there who may, think differently, but I've tried not to look at percentage drop, but look at dollar drop. And in some ways, We're only, and I don't mean to be rude here or seem cynical, but we're where we were like in 2016 or 2017. It's not that we have dropped way down. So the percentage might be huge, but in terms of the dollars we have to actually operate with, that's what we're looking at and thinking about. Phil, what other advice would you give in general to our community of facing this?
I think we have just this unique opportunity from our vantage point to sort of engage and be there and be responsive, right? And one of the other things that we are offering is like we're offering one-year subscriptions to Zoom for any of our nonprofit partners that are trying to figure out how to transition to a virtual environment. So really just listening to folks and hearing what they're saying, what their needs are, has been important. I think being lean foundations, we can be more nimble and responsive. And I think we've already seen that in New York, where there are a lot of initiatives that are starting to take place and they're starting to unfold. But being able to move more quickly, and as we think we have, and we're trying to be responsive in a quick way, has actually been reassuring for our grantees. And it was a reminder to us that we have that benefit of being able to do that. And really, from the trust-based perspective, flexible support, general operating is critical and it's key. And in this moment, letting our grantee partners make those decisions in terms of what's important and how to move forward, and really believing that they know the best way to steward those resources.
Yeah, thank. And you know, Phil's a great leader, as I said, and model in this trust. And I think a lot of us are finding that that's what we need to do now to support our communities. Phil, before I let you go, somebody reminded me, I think you were listing six responses that you had. We got through number four, and then we went off on a tangent. So they're asking where there are a couple more to go.
Oh, so with the Zoom accounts, we have had a lot of folks take us up on that. The other two are, one is that certainly we're going to engage and listen to some of the other short-term responses that are happening in the city. Many of them are pooled or collaborative initiatives. And the last one is really advocating for releasing restrictions if there are program grants, and really advocating for general operating. So you've heard me talk about that. And in some ways, hopefully we've done that. So if you have heard about this pledge in the response to COVID-19 that is now up on the Council on Foundation site, we had a hand in shaping that, the trust-based philanthropy project. So it's really asking people to kind of relax a lot of the restrictions in this moment so that our grantee partners can do their work.
Great. And I'll also add on the flip side that the National Council of Nonprofits has been leading a lot of effort to get nonprofits included in some of the legislation that's being passed on Capitol Hill, being talked about, so that nonprofits also benefit from whatever the government might decide to do or not do as we move forward. So, Phil, thank you very much for that, and I hope you are going to be able to stick around a little bit. And now I'd like to move on to our third guest, Jenna Watchman. Jenna is with the Ball Brothers Foundation in Muncie, Indiana, and as with all three or all of your two colleagues beforehand, Jenna, in normal times, what do you focus on?
Sure. Well, Ball Brothers Foundation is 90 years old, so we've seen the good and the bad, and it's really a foundation that's very place-based as well. We focus on arts and education, quality of life, with 95% of our funding staying in Muncie and Delaware County, Indiana. And so we provide general operating support, program grants, and capital grants. And so we accept unsolicited proposals, and then each year we do a handful of solicited proposals as well. So under normal circumstances, that's sort of the way we operate.
And what's different this week?
Sure. Well, we are really fortunate. A number of years ago, our board and staff instituted something that we call a rapid grant process. And so we accept applications throughout the year. We don't have deadlines on them, where we allow organizations to submit proposals for up to $5,000. And we have two simple questions that they answer on our online system, which is essentially, what do you propose to do with funding, and what will you accomplish? And we also ask them to submit a simple budget form. We have a turnaround time, typically in normal times, of about 1 week, in which we're able to provide an answer and start to get money out the door. So what we've done is we've just taken that system and we have sped up the process, and we've also invited some select organizations to apply for funding. So we've had conversations over the past several weeks with folks at the hospital in our community, with our local EMS and local law enforcement. We've been kind of quietly having those conversations over the phone or in person, and saying, you know, as this starts to ramp up, what needs might you have? And so last Friday, then, we began issuing invitations to apply through our rapid grant process. We've issued about 20 invitations to date. And so we've had organizations applying through that process. Our local hospital, we've invited federally qualified healthcare centers, our local food bank and hot meal distributors, childcare providers, law enforcement agencies, homeless services, and senior services in our community to apply using that very simple process. And we've had a good response. So.
I want to just go off on a little vector here for a moment. I was speaking with Jenna last week, and she shared that rapid response, quick money out the door. As I said earlier at the top of our program, you might hear an idea and you might riff on it a little bit, make it a little bit different for your needs or whatnot. Well, Jenna shared that with me last week in the foundation where I'm a trustee. We began reaching out directly to many of our grantees in the direct service business on the phone and saying, could you use $5,000 right now, perhaps to help with extra cleaning? Perhaps you have somebody who's out ill or whatever. Would $5,000 be helpful? And if they said yes, we just put a check in the mail. It was as simple as that. And that, I think, ties back to a lot of what Phil was talking about. The idea of, these are people we know and we trust. And so, I've always maintained that the nonprofits are our teachers. They know the needs better than we think we do. We can become very knowledgeable, but ultimately they know. So we have to trust them. So, Jenna was influential in that way. So I'm going to publicly thank you. What's been the reaction from the community? Are people jumping right in? Because we had a couple people who said, wow, that's a generous offer, but, you know, give me a few days. I want to assess what's going on. The nonprofit was not just grabbing the check and running.
Sure.
How's it gone in Muncie?
It's a great question. To be very candid, so out of about 20 invitations that we issued, we've awarded about 9 grants to date. And we had a number of organizations who said to us, thank you so much. We would like to apply, but we're not sure what our need is yet. And so that was a little bit surprising to us, but also really, really reiterated to us that people in our community are being very thoughtful. And so we've been really pleased. We have sort of expanded our process or tried to make our process even more simple. So I think in the best case scenario, I think our record time to get an application from the time the grantee hit submit until the time that we delivered by hand a check to them was about 3 hours. So we're really, our team is kind of on full alert throughout this process and has done a really great job of kind of simplifying and streamlining as much as we can to get those dollars out the door. But the needs that have come in, again, sort of like you said, Henry, they're things we would never know as a staff. We don't know what our grantees really need. And so we had our local ambulance service applied, and we funded respirators for them to carry on their ambulances. We funded one of our local health clinics once to use our funding, and we awarded it to spin up some mental telehealth services. A childcare agency is going to use some funding to provide childcare for hospital employees. A homeless service provider will use our funding to professionally clean their buildings and then teach their staff how to clean them properly, given this response. Those were things that we would never know as funders were the most immediate needs. And so we've really trusted our grantees to let us know what they need and to turn that funding around as quickly as we possibly can.
So I want to ask you a question that I had also asked Lauren, and Phil, I'd like you to chime in because I'm not sure we went down this path as well, but how are you handling the well-being of your staff? As small as it may be, you talked about doing this in 3 hours, you're hand delivering checks, you're out there in the community, opportunities for just caring for the health and safety of your staff and yourself, the 6 feet rule, that kind of thing, or 6 foot rule, excuse me. But what else are you doing? And then Phil, I'd love to hear your thoughts as well.
Sure. Well, we're all working from home. A couple of us have been going into the office from time to time, hand delivering those checks when we can, or sort of leaving them at the doorstep and letting people know they're waiting for you. We've been very careful about that. From a logistical standpoint, our executive assistant had a great idea early on, which was our staff has a phone call every morning at 9 o'clock to check in, since we're all working remotely, just as a way of staying connected. And I think that has been really helpful. And we typically use a portion of that staff meeting just to say, how is everybody doing? How are your families? Just to really check in.
And Phil?
It would be very similar to Jenna's. So this is our second week of working remotely, and we're probably preparing for the long run like many of you. We think shelter in place is actually going to happen here in New York City probably over the weekend, and so that will keep us out of the office for the foreseeable future. We do a weekly check-in meeting call for everybody, but we make it an intentional thing that we reach out to one another over the course of the week as well individually so that we can just sort of make sure everyone's doing okay. And really giving people the autonomy and flexibility to do what they need to do and to work in whatever time feels right for them and given this situation. So really trying to encourage people to do self-care, or we would call it community care, that we take care of one another. And so really just encouraging people to take the time that they need to do their work is going to be a long haul. And so if you're not taking care of yourself now, then you can't help people later.
I totally agree with both of you. I mean, at Exponent, we've got a staff of about 18 or 19, and we're making extensive use of Zoom so that we're having staff meetings. I personally really believe in the importance of the visual connection not just a conference call. I've been having virtual lunches with some of my colleagues. We'll both sit in front of our screens and sit there and, you know, talk about what each one's eating and what else is going on and just have that few minutes. Late this afternoon, we're having an all staff virtual happy hour. Again, just to keep that sense of community and make sure people are taking time to not feel isolated, because there are some staff people who live alone and it can get very lonely very fast. So I think that's really important that all of us keep that kind of thing going. Jenna, jumping back to Ball Brothers, what about the financial considerations in your case?
Sure. I think like everybody on the call, our assets have significantly diminished over the past 2 weeks. And so we're monitoring that, but really we're focusing on what we can control. And so that's, we have a good investment policy statement and we're sticking very closely to that. But we're really focusing on what we can control, which is the grant making side. So we will continue to honor the commitments that we've made. We make multi-year grants. And so we'll continue to honor those commitments that we made through the multi-year. We'll continue to honor the payout that we had committed to earlier in this year. And then from there, we're sort of shuffling and kind of being as responsive as we can, and we'll do the best we can given the situation. So
one of the among the attributes I often talk about that all of you, all of our members, share is the ability to be nimble, agile, responsive. And I think this is, you know, we're hearing stories of that, of where people are doing it. And that I really believe is one of the great beauties of all of us in this community of being small staff. It's very hands-on. It's very personal. And I think it also allows greater amounts of trust with your grantees. And there's a piece of me, Jenna, that's sort of really thrilled that some of them said, well, you know, that's very generous, but we need to really think about what we're doing, because I think that suggests a high level of trust and a very positive relationship between you or Ball Brothers and that nonprofit, that you can have that degree of honesty and not just say, great, we'll take the money and run with it. I want to let everybody know that in a couple minutes, I've got sort of one more question for Jenna, that, you know, if you've got questions that we want to ask, you know, specific questions for Phil or Jenna or myself, Madeline's going to help me wade through those. So just type away and we're going to try and do as best we can on them. So Jenna, as a final question or thought from you at this point, you know, what's your advice to the community of your colleagues here?
Sure. That's a great question. Our staff talked a little bit about this morning, just kind of shared with them what we would be talking about this afternoon. And one of the things that came up is just the idea of having a measured response, but also don't overthink. You know, these are unprecedented times. And so if there's a way that you can respond, do that. You know, too much analysis leads to paralysis, right? And so so be wise and do your due diligence, but also if there's a way that you can move forward with making some decisions, do that. Stick to your values, stick to your systems, and look for ways to speed up your process. For us, that was as we kind of looked at our process, one of the points that we saw that would slow things down was really using the mail. You know, would it take an extra 3 to 5 days to get a check through the mail? And so for us, that was sort of the hand delivery, taking careful precautions. But for us, we're going to use that for a little while, and we'll see if we need to reevaluate. But just looking for those ways to speed up the process. The other piece of advice would really be, what can you do beyond dollars? And for us, our president had a really good conversation with Red Cross. And many of you have seen the concern about blood donation. And so look for ways that your foundation can use its voice. And so we as a foundation will be posting a video later this afternoon to our Facebook page, encouraging people in our community to be blood donors. And so amplify the voice of your grantees. The Red Cross has been a longtime grantee of ours. And so we said, what is a way that we can amplify their work and their voice and have an outsized impact in that way. And so for us, it was really carrying that message of blood donation. So again, there are other ways that foundations can help beyond dollars. And I would encourage you to think about what you can do in your community to help in that regard.
And if you want to go looking on Facebook for that, it's the Ball Brothers Foundation from Muncie, Indiana. And, you know, I would hope that all of us are always thinking about ways beyond dollars, but perhaps now's the time to amp that up. I think there was also something very important in the beginning of your last remark, Jenna, which is, and it echoes, I think, something I said at the very beginning, which is that you need to also trust yourself, and, you know, not get hung up in overanalyzing or worrying, what if, because sometimes the moment and the need will become exasperated if it's not addressed quickly. So you should trust yourself. And I think another really important point you made there was, I think sometimes as funders, we deal at a level up here and we're thinking about what are they using it for? What's the purpose? All that kind of stuff. But then, and we talk about streamlining and whatnot, but also thinking about what appear to be very small things, but in this situation are big things. So let's not put the check in the mail, and it could take 2, 3, 4 days to get there. Let's go hand deliver the check. Doesn't sound like a big thing, but that's huge if somebody needs it and they need it quickly. And so all great points. I'd like to ask both of you a question. Any suggestion? I mean, both of your boards are responding rapidly, quickly, but what about boards that perhaps only meet a couple times a year? Maybe it's a family foundation and they meet, you know, at Thanksgiving and, you know, the June family gathering or something, and they may be geographically dispersed. Any thoughts on how to get them into that rapid response mode?
I'll jump in and just say we have begun updating our board sort of on a weekly basis now.
Is all your board local to the Muncie area?
No, they are not at all. They're geographically distributed across the United States. And so email for us is sort of the best way of staying in contact with them. And so we're kind of setting up a process where we'll update them on a weekly basis just on grants that were made through our rapid response process. Also about feedback that we're receiving in the community. I think that's an important part of what we need to do in messaging that to our board is also showing, you know, we got an email earlier today from a law enforcement officer thanking us for the grant that we awarded to our local police department for protective gear for the police officers. And just he was expressing his personal thanks just because of concern with his own family and protecting his own family after having so many community interactions. And so I think telling those stories to our boards and showing the impact of the work that we do through storytelling is so important. And so that's another one of the reasons that that we're also going to be doing some more video updates from our president and COO is just to help both our board and our community to visually see and understand and to kind of help cut through the clutter of so much messaging that's coming our way.
And I don't remember, maybe it was Lauren, maybe it was you, Phil, but I'm looking in the questions or the comments too. Something that we should all be looking to is just electronic transfer of funds so that there's not even that check to deliver. I just read or got an email this morning from PNC Bank where they're closing many of their branches. And having selective branches open, looking at wider areas of service. So it may be tougher, literally, to take a check to the bank and deposit it. And I'm not sure I'm interested in running up to an ATM right now unless I have my box of, you know, wipes and bottle of Clorox or whatever. So that's another thing we could all be looking into. Phil, did you have any thoughts on the board? Is your board all local or is it geographically dispersed?
It's a little geographically dispersed, but for what we did over the weekend and in terms of our own action, we have used email and they have the authority to use kind of a virtual environment to make decisions and approve things. And so we just enacted that and may use that as our vehicle. Like Jenna and others, we're using weekly updates just so that our board can stay attuned and stay abreast of what's happening more widely here across New York City, but also with us as the foundation.
Great. Madeline, are there particular questions? I'm sort of listening and trying to read, and I'm not good at multitasking.
Yeah, there are a few questions that have popped up that haven't been answered. And if people have responses to these, you can put them in the chat window and I'll read them out loud. But someone asked if anyone found a mechanism for emergency grants to individuals who are suddenly unemployed but might be gig workers or people who don't have traditional access to get unemployment benefits or other social services.
Yeah, I haven't. I don't know if Jenna or Phil, you have heard of that. I haven't. I mean, you know, there's expenditure responsibilities and ways to provide funds directly. That may be an area that is an opportunity for some legislative action to allow some loosening of those rules, at least for the time being. But I don't know if either of you have any experience with that. No. Yeah, it's a great question, and I think it's a really important one. Unfortunately, I don't think I have a good answer on that.
Let me look. Someone also asked if, how are you weighing kind of the current unknowns about how the federal government will react to this and the support they're providing with the funding that you're already providing? So how are you weighing that at all? Is that a factor? And how would that maybe change your strategy based on what is enacted?
I know what I would say, but I'm interested in Jenna or Phil.
So I can jump in and say, we've spent some time this week talking with our local small business administration folks, with local insurance agent, who's fielding a lot of calls about sort of business continuity and things along those lines, and also with some of our local organizations that support entrepreneurs. And so we're keeping an eye on what might be done from a federal level or a state level, but we're very mindful of the fact that that process tends to be fairly slow and somewhat cumbersome, at least it has been in the past. And so for organizations in our community that need help immediately, there are very few organizations or institutions other than private foundations or community foundations that are set up to be nimble and quick and responsive. And so for us and for our staff, we have really viewed this as a key opportunity for us to respond to very practical community needs and to be able to do that in a smart way and in a thoughtful way, but to be able to do something that government is not set up to do at this point in time. So, we'll be there and continue to monitor that and stay in conversation with folks in our community who can help us interpret all of that. But for now, we see ourselves as playing kind of a critical gap filler role.
And Phil?
I think for us right now, we are looking at kind of more mid to long term. We know that there's a long tail to this and that this will go on for a while. And so part of our immediate response is really kind of looking at the long term, longer term, and assuring everybody that we will be there. And so that's where this plus one, this additional year support, is part of that kind of strategy to really let folks know that we're going to be there. We have a number of different initiatives here in New York City that are trying to do some more immediate responses right now. And so we are trying to go in and listen and decide how to engage and participate with some of these more collaborative efforts so that we're not all stepping on each other's toes and there's a more of a coordinated response. So that's how we're trying to handle both of those sides.
Really important point there in Phil's last sentence or two about, I think it's incumbent upon all of us within our communities to be talking to other funders, so that we aren't stepping on each other's toes. You know, the worst thing potentially is that all of us think we're doing the great thing and we pour all our money at the same place, whereas there are other organizations that could use the funding and aren't being addressed. So just keeping everybody in the loop so the left hand knows what the right hand is doing. My own feeling, at the risk of sounding too cynical, regarding certainly the federal government, is that we can't wait for them. The need is immediate. We know our communities certainly better than they do, and we need to take action. And if they end up bellying up to the bar and providing additional resources, well, so much the better. If we wait for them, I think there'll be people who will be in more dire straits than they potentially are today or on their way to falling into. So that's just my non-political view. Other questions, Madeline?
There are a few more. And as I said, again, if you have some, type them in the chat. One person asked how folks are able to provide extra funds on early release or in advance without sacrificing the ability to fund later in the year when the funds will still be needed?
Well, you know, I think, I'm going to turn to Jenna and Phil, but I think there's an important lesson here, and that what I've learned from my work in disaster philanthropy, and disaster being more of what we would think when we hear that term, so hurricane, flooding, earthquake, et cetera, is that there are multiple phases. And in some regards, we're in what I call the blanket and coffee phase, where the need is immediate. There are people who need medical care, they need protection, they need money for food, they need money to be in clean environments if they're running an organization. But there are subsequent stages to this whole process where people will need money to get to rebuild organizations. I fully expect that there may be, both adults and children who downstream will need mental health counseling, having been through all of this. I know we've seen that in hurricanes. That kind of thing. So there is a balance of thinking about your portfolio and how you manage the funds. But my own feeling is that this need is immediate. It's critical. And if we don't deal with this stage right now, those subsequent stages will be of much less import. Having said that, Jenna or Phil,
I would just say, I think we have this artificial construct that it's 5%, and I would invite everybody to think about piercing that. And this is an unprecedented time and a moment, and to think about, like, how can we best respond and support the community and our nonprofits? So
I could not agree more about the 5%. It's just some legislator or some lobbyist came up with that number at some point, and it's not at all tied to need. And Jenna?
Sure, I would just reiterate a lot of what Henry said as well, is just this idea of not also having a scarcity mindset, but also, there are very few organizations and institutions that are blessed with the resources that private foundations are blessed with. And so think about how you can maximize your impact, and be mindful and careful, but also think about responding to the immediate need right now.
Yes, exactly. Madeline?
Yeah. One person just asked how foundations are handling local, national, and global support and pooled funds, and there were a few people in the chat that shared what their foundation is doing. So I'm going to read those responses.
Sure.
And then if the Jenna and Phil and you, Henry, if you have anything else to add, we can hear you after. But one person said that in collaboration with six major funders in their county, they worked on a pool co-funding opportunity where organizations submit one application to all participating funders to review. And then they're holding at least a weekly funder collaborative call, and to, I guess, talk about that. And then they're also looking to host standing weekly calls with their grantee partners to share the resources and keep everyone up to the changes that they're making. And then another person said that after meeting with their county health department last week, their private foundation has provided funds along with another family foundation and a community foundation to provide an emergency or to form an emergency fund at their United Way to administer. They felt that in this case, the United Way was closer to the ground and more on top of the situation. And that's why they went with the United Way to handle the emergency fund.
Jen and Phil, any thoughts on those pooled and particularly the national and global? I mean, Jenny, you're in Muncie and that's where most things are happening for you. But as we all know, this is a worldwide issue.
Sure. I don't have any comments on the national or the global piece of it, but just on the pooled funds, that's something we've been in close communication with our local community foundation and with other funders in the community, and would just encourage you all, communication is key, right? Making sure that other funders know what you're doing so that you can coordinate responses. And also remember, the nonprofits in our communities have limited time. They're dealing with this crisis in their own way with their own constituents. And so the last thing we want is for them to have to answer the same questions for our foundation as they've answered already for the community foundation and the other foundation down the street. And so the more work that we can do as funders to simplify that process by staying in good communication with each other, the better to make it easier for our grantees and to make it so that our grantees can actually focus on doing the work that needs to be done. We don't want to create artificial barriers for them or waste their time explaining their needs to us when they've just done that. So,
just quickly, you know, we're place-based funders. We're focused on New York City, and that is kind of where our commitment is. Going national and going global, that we don't have any expertise or any knowledge, and there's so we're gonna stay close to home and play where kind of our own understanding and our own expertise lies. And so that's where our primary commitment is.
The
many others who already have that kind of knowledge and understanding, and so we will let them in many ways lead that charge.
You know, I think that's the answer for the person who asked that, that hopefully we all know the space we worked in. In Phil's case, it's New York City. In Jenna's case, it's Muncie, Indiana. Somebody else might be in their normal course of business, a global funder, whether it's in, you know, Africa, India, South America, wherever. And so, you know, that neighborhood. And I use that term broadly, but so that's where you can be reaching out to those people to help on a global basis. That's also where your local knowledge and your trust of your community and your trust of yourself, because you know that, comes into play. So it's, you know, sort of staying close to what you know, or then I think you do run the risk of perhaps getting into trouble in the sense of heading off on a tangent that may not be the best thing for you. And picking up on Jenna's remark about keeping the everybody informed locally, you know, this is the shameless plug. We're going to be doing these conversations every Friday going forward. Different people, if there are particular topics that you think we should be addressing, should we do one of these with a couple of people from the investment world or EDs who are dealing with that particularly to address some of those questions that people have brought up? We'd love to hear from you because we want to make this work for all of us, but there'll be plenty of opportunities to share and to hear from one another, and that's ultimately how I think we'll all get through this together. Madeline, other questions?
Yeah, there's another question that kind of plays off what we were just talking about. And they asked, is anyone having trouble navigating the myriad of response funds popping up, not only at community foundations, but within like other giving vehicles? And they were wondering, is it best to just give one, like make one larger gift to a fund so that it can be allocated correctly, or should you make smaller gifts to multiple funds for a different approach to your grant making?
Phil or Jenna, either of you have a thought on that one? Oh, Jenna? Or were you shaking no?
I mean, I really think it's up to you and up to your board and really making a decision based on your own philosophy and values and the organizations that you have great relationships with and feel like can make the biggest difference.
I think that's very true. It's fund where you know, fund the organizations that you know. That's the whole part about having that relationship, trusting, knowing that it'll go well. The idea of a pooled fund is great if you don't really know where the specific needs are, but you should be putting that money into a pooled fund, being operated by or being run by, whatever the right word is, by people you trust. That may be a community foundation in your community. And that's where you want to give the money. It may be a religious-based organization that you trust will be doing the right thing, that sort of thing. So just be careful of blindly writing checks. And frankly, I mean, this maybe applies more to individuals, but, you know, I've already started to see some scams showing up. You know, contribute money here. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. So make sure you do know who you're funding and what you're funding, which is why if you're dealing with existing grantees, you're past that step and you know who you're dealing with. Madeline, how are we doing? While she's looking, I'll also mention we're gonna, this is being recorded, so it'll be available. You know, as I said, we're gonna do these every week. We're putting together some more resources. If you go to our homepage, there's a link there to more resources, and we're gonna pull stuff out of this, that people have been putting into the chat log. I can only read it partly, as I'm talking, to make all this available. I mean, this really is about sharing with one another.
Yeah. I have another story to share. Someone said that they were moving all of their existing grantees to unrestricted operating, support so that their, grantee partners would have maximum flexibility to meet the crisis. And then someone else said that they were going to partner with their Chamber of Commerce Foundation to provide small businesses support and offer a little bit of relief there. And I'm not seeing any new questions.
Okay.
I don't know if people have thoughts on those ideas on how to respond.
Okay. Jenna, Phil, any, I'll say closing remarks, but maybe that's not the right word, closing, because we'll be back next week, not necessarily with you two in the hot seat, but from what you've heard, what we've talked about, things that the pearls of wisdom people should walk away with, so to speak. One of you was muted, I think.
I'll just say keep listening to the community and what people are saying and telling you, and hopefully be nimble and being able to respond and just sort of hear them, because that is the best information that we can get at this point.
I would agree with Phil. Really, these are unprecedented times, and so you know, try not to be too fearful of making a mistake, and press forward with doing what you know how to do and what you know how to do well, and be confident in your decision and in your recommendations for funding.
And I would say, go ahead,
which was trust yourself.
Yeah.
This is really key in this moment.
It's trust yourself, trust your grantees, and as Jenna said, don't be afraid of making a mistake. Few things in our world of funding are, you know, we all too often we say something worked or something didn't, and we make it a binary. And that's rarely the case, that something totally fails or is totally perfect. So what you might think of as a mistake might still have achieved 70, 80, 90% of what it was intended to do and helped somebody along. These are interesting times indeed. So I want to thank Lauren, who's off to her executive committee, but particular thanks to Jenna and Phil for taking your time today, sharing your wisdom. They were also both involved in some email conversations getting ready for it. They just didn't show up at the last minute, although I suspect both of them could because they're that solid of people and grant makers. I want to thank certainly all of you for coming and joining us with us and sticking with us. My colleague Madeline and the entire staff that helped put this together, my thanks to them. As I said, we'll be doing this next week. Madeline, do you have any closing thoughts on how to keep sharing or?
Yeah, I want to thank everyone too for joining the call. At our largest, we were 335 people on this one Zoom meeting, which I think is really impressive. And I appreciate you taking the time to learn. If you have any more questions, thoughts, ideas, topics that you want us to cover later, you can post about it in our discussion community or email info@exponentphilanthropy.org, and we'll take all of those ideas into consideration as we move forward with these chats that we're having on Friday afternoon. But yeah, thank you, everyone.
And with that, I'm going to, again, thank you all, implore you all to stay safe, and I will give you a collective elbow bump since we're not shaking hands these days. And again, Jenna, Phil, and Madeline, thanks so much. And we'll see you all next week.
Thank you.